There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good afternoon, you are listening to The Grill. We are live at Barasti where the game is always on. No Tom Urquhart today, he is taking a well-earned summer break. It is myself, Chris McCarty, overseeing proceedings over the course of the next 3 hours. And what a 3 hours we have got for you. An awful lot of live sport to keep you across. It is Moving Saturday over at Carnoustie, host venue of the 147th Open Championship. We will have updates as we go today. Two Americans top the leaderboard, Zach Johnson and Kevin Kisner on 6 under par. What can Tiger Woods do, I wonder? Today he is off very, very shortly. It is qualifying over in Germany for the Formula One Grand Prix. Wet conditions over there in Hockenheim. We'll give you an update on that. There's live cricket over in Colombo. It is day two of the second test between Sri Lanka and South Africa. Updates as we go. Super Rugby quarter-final weekend. 2 down, 2 to go. We'll have updates of the Waratahs versus the Highlands, and then we Highlanders, and then we're building up as well to the Lions versus the Jaguars. It is stage 13 of the Tour de France, a fifth day in the Alps. We saw Peter Sagan win yesterday. Geraint Thomas is still the man to catch, though, in that yellow jersey. There is a host of pre-season friendlies to keep you across. Club football has returned. There's the very latest transfer news, and there's all of the hangover from the FIFA World Cup. Yes, it is now 6 days and counting since we bid farewell to arguably the greatest World Cup of all. We'll also look back on the week's biggest stories as we say a fond farewell to a high-profile rugby star. There's also news of a call-up, an Indian test call-up, that is, for a Chinaman. Yes, you heard that correctly, a Chinaman. You are listening to The Grill, then. We are live with you through until 6 p.m. And as always, you can get in touch with us on 4001. Stay tuned.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
A warm, warm welcome, then, to the show. It has just gone 3:05 on your Saturday afternoon. We are live. Live coming to you from Barasti, 20 or so screens dotted throughout the venue, the only place to catch all your live sport across the weekend. We are with you, as I say, for the next 3 hours. We are open to you guys to join in the conversation as well, so do get in touch on 4001. There's an awful lot to get through this afternoon, and I'm delighted to say that I've pulled together, well, the A-team this afternoon. I've gone for a mixture of experience and youth. The old campaigner himself, Mark Archer, is sitting alongside me to the left, and I will say a very good afternoon, first and foremost, to you, Mark Archer.
Afternoon, Chris. Afternoon, listener. Yeah, good to be back in Dubai. It's been a hectic week for me, but looking forward. Plenty of sporting action taking place live around the world, and not a lot of football to talk about, which hasn't been the case for the last 5 or 6 weeks. It's all been about the World Cup, and it's the calm down here at Barasti after the storm, because I've got to say, Barasti has been ram-jammed for about 6 weeks. Amazing scenes down here. And just a little bit more subdued this afternoon. But if you are looking for something to do this afternoon, plenty of sport to watch, get on down here.
It certainly is. And you say that it has been a busy week for you. I think you've taken in Beirut, you've taken in Istanbul, you were over in Moscow as well for the FIFA World Cup final. So we'll be getting Mark Archer's appraisal of that World Cup final last Sunday. So that's the experienced head ticked off. Delighted to say as well, we've got a debutant on the panel this weekend. He is a man, former deputy sports editor of the second biggest news portal now on the planet, because the Sun newspaper, which I won't get into, I think has taken on that mantle as the number one news portal in the world. But delighted to be joined by Matthew Fortune, and I will say a very good afternoon to you, Matthew.
Thanks very much, Chris, and good afternoon to you. Just to clarify, it was the first still under my watch.
It was the number one before you left. It is the Sun newspaper now, though.
It is,
which is a bizarre one. Anyone that's been onto that website will know that it pales into insignificance in many respects for me on Mail Online. But that is enough of my guilty pleasures, the showbiz section between 1 and 1:30 most weekdays. Matthew Fortune is alongside us. We're going to be looking back on the FIFA World Cup. There's an awful lot of transfer news. Matthew's also going to be keeping an eye on the Tour de France. It is stage 13 today. But before we move on, gentlemen, and there's an awful lot to get through, I want to go back, if we can, to that FIFA World Cup. It was last Sunday, which it seems almost an age since that FIFA World Cup final last Sunday evening. France the victors, 4-2 on the night against Croatia. You were there, first and foremost, Mark. Put us in the picture of exactly what the atmosphere was like over in Moscow for that final.
No, it was a great atmosphere. What's funny about when you go to finals, particularly like a World Cup, there's a lot of neutral fans there. So a lot of you sit amongst the crowd, and obviously there's French fans and Croatian fans in the stadium wanting to watch their teams win. But I think a lot of people pre-book tickets for finals. So you're sitting amongst Brazilians and Argentinians and Colombians and Mexicans, Germans, from all the nations, even English, a few Englishmen showed up, even though I think they had hoped they might be in the final a couple of days before. So it's a very cosmopolitan, international crowd. And I've got to say, it was an amazing atmosphere. I think the Croatian fans, whilst being underdogs on the pitch, they showed up on force, and they probably outnumbered the French fans in the stadium. And I also think it's fair to say that most neutrals who were in the stadium wanted to see Croatia do well, or perhaps create the upset. There was a great underdog story, wasn't it? It was the nation of 4.5 million taking on the previous champions' nation of 70 million in France, with all the big name stars that they have in every position, and against, you know, one or two, the Modrics and Rakitic's and the players that really emerged from Croatia throughout the tournament that weren't, people didn't know a lot about Subasic in goal and Vida in defence, and these players that we hadn't heard a lot of before, Perisic even to a degree. So it was a great atmosphere, a very rushed trip for me. We only decided to go on Thursday once Croatia made the final. Scattered about trying to find some tickets. Finally got to Moscow. We were actually at a wedding in the hills of Lebanon on Saturday night. We had to get a plane at 3 a.m. and arrive via Istanbul at 12 o'clock on Sunday to actually then find the fan ID, which I know you guys have been through. You know exactly what's involved there, Matt and yourself, trying to find fan ID, trying to find physically get the tickets for the match, and then find a hotel amongst 4 or 5 hours before a World Cup final. So it was a traumatic experience. First ever World Cup game I've actually been to in my bucket list of sports. So I've done pretty much everything I've wanted to do.
I've done everything
in my life in terms of finals and big events. It was amazing. And you know what was nice about the game afterwards? You know, we went to some football matches earlier, and they went to the FA Cup final where Man United and Chelsea battled out, and there were some ugly scenes in the fans. There was a lot of verbal nonsense going on, a lot of fans giving it to their own team and their own manager. After the game, what was really nice for me, and it shows like the spirit of football and the football festival of the World Cup, is fans from all the countries were swapping the shirts.
Yeah, I love it.
Whether you be a Brazilian or an Argentinian or a Croatian or a French fan, everyone was just going around swapping shirts to commemorate the moment of being at a World Cup final. So it was just, that was really cool. And you know, and it was bizarre because after the game ended, the torrential rain came down. So no one really left. No one wanted to go get soaked. And it was not easy getting in and out of stadiums at World Cup final. So everyone sat around. We watched all the French celebrate. We watched the Croatian team graciously kind of do the guard of honour, as both teams did for each other. There was a lot of respect between the teams. It was a pretty good final. I think there was goals, there was
final
action, there was drama. In some ways, it encapsulated the whole World Cup. It had a bit of everything. Had controversy, had VAR, had a couple of great goals, had a penalty. It was just a really good final. And, you know, so I think in the end of the day, for me, the best team throughout the World Cup won the final. And I'll go on record saying I did pick France before the event.
Yeah, you did. Well done.
But then again, you wanted the underdog story was there as well. So it had a bit of everything. It really encapsulated a great World Cup. Congratulations to FIFA under pressure to put on a good World Cup. And congratulations to the hosts in Russia. I think they did a fantastic job. I know you guys went to some of the games, but Moscow was a delightful city to visit in 24 hours. And I think I didn't hear a lot of bad things come out of the World Cup as a whole. So, yeah, amazing experience for 24 hours.
You are right to point out, Archie, that you and I, Matthew, we popped on over for about 4 to 8 hours, as it was for Belgium against Brazil over in Kazan. We got a front row seat, in many respects, to the carnival that was the FIFA World Cup over in Russia. I know an awful lot's been written. Column inches have been filled over the past 6 days about how special Russia was as a host, how special the tournament was. An awful lot of people, myself included, and I'm guilty of this, have jumped on the bandwagon to say the best World Cup, certainly in my lifetime. Do you agree with what you saw and from the games themselves?
It's an interesting argument, Chris. I think it's easier now to remember things through social media, through how people can talk about them. I think focusing on the England team, everybody says this was the greatest atmosphere around the England team, but it's because we had access to all of the players so much more than we normally do, than we have done previously. In my lifetime, from a memory perspective, certainly I've enjoyed the Russia World Cup more than anything else previously. Is that because I'm a little bit biased that my home country were doing better than we seem to have done for such a long time? I think so. But touching on Mark's story, the collaboration and the collective, while in the stands that we noticed, even with the Brazilian fans milling with the other fans around, we were totally wrapped up in that. We weren't looked upon, very clearly not wearing Samba or having the dancing skills of anybody else around us. But that whole thing was then mirrored on the pitch. It was all about the collective. If you ask for some standout players, you don't really lean on a particular individual. Of course, players like Mbappe, Modric, they all had outstanding moments, but it was all about the collective and how those individual players fitted in to the ethos of the team, even Mbappe. That France team, everybody was apart from Mark, I understand, but was suggesting that they weren't going to be the sum of their parts, but actually they were a greater sum of all of the stars within that team and delivered performances over and over again, and as Mark says, were the right winners.
Yeah, it is worth pointing out that we always say, did the best team at the tournament win the FIFA World Cup? And you look at the stats, France didn't lose a game. They drew that game. The only 0-0 that we saw in 64 matches over in Russia was France 0, Denmark 0. But you look across the board, they weren't taken to extra time, ever. They weren't taken to penalties, obviously, because they weren't taken to extra time. And over the piece, it was a case that France actually got better as the tournament wore on.
Yeah, that's correct. And it was funny because the final was a really strange game because France set up really defensively. And I guess you look back and say it was a tactical masterpiece by Deschamps, the team that had all the stars, all the big names at the biggest clubs in every position, you know, were superstars. And you would have thought they would have taken the game to Croatia. Yet, in the first half of that game, Croatia played all the football.
Dominated, yeah.
They played the football. France only had real two scoring opportunities. One was the free kick, which was controversial given, and then it was an own goal from Mandžukić, flicked on the head that flicked on the far post. And then it was the penalty, which was controversial. In the stadium at the time, we knew it was a handball VAR situation, but you don't see the replay in the stadium, and you don't really know what happened and how it happened. And then the longer it drags on, the referee goes back to VAR, you go, uh-oh, penalty coming here.
Yeah.
You just think that somebody's reviewing it. It looks like the ref didn't want to give it. But those were the two chances real that France had clear cut.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
Welcome back to The Grill. You are listening to Dubai 103.8. It is myself, Chris McCarty, joined this afternoon by Mark Archer and Matthew Fortune. We're taking a look back on the FIFA World Cup. There's an awful lot of live sport to keep you up to date with as well. We will do that as we go this evening all the way through until 6 o'clock. I just want to draw a line under the FIFA World Cup very quickly before we move on. I'll ask you this question, Matthew. Was it a penalty for France? An awful lot has been said, written. We were inundated with texts on Monday Night Football questioning the validity of the decision. For you, penalty?
Well, I think that's two questions, Chris. From a cliche alert perspective, yes, it was a penalty by the letter of the law. However, VAR was in place to rectify clear and obvious errors. And I know this has been said before, but if you have to go and watch a TV screen with multiple camera angles showing multiple replays, then walk away, then go back and check again, it's probably not a clear and obvious mistake. So should it have been given as a penalty? In my opinion, no. Was it a penalty? Probably. I know that's
cop-out, but we'll let you off with it. You've been listening to this show an awful lot with Mark Archer for an answer like that. But you're right to point that out. The fact that the referee himself, and you're right, he made the decision, was walking away from the screen and thought, oh, wait, let me just watch it one more time to make sure that I'm getting this decision right.
The interesting thing with VAR was, how many times did they go to the screen in the middle of the pitch in the knockout stages? I would suggest very few, if any at all.
I can't recall any.
After the controversy of the Iran game in that final group stage match, they stopped. There is suspicion that they were told to stop going to the screen because of the drama, because no one else in the stadium has any idea what's going on, and they didn't. That was the first time in a number of games that they did. And I don't think that's right, Chris. I really think that, therefore, the referee was under more pressure, which, as you say, he went back to the screen, and it just felt so uncomfortable. And in a game of that magnitude, at that time in the game, when Croatia are the better team, it was a big, big call.
Yeah, I always think, had he not given the decision, would we be talking about it the next day? I always think with decisions, you kind of know when a decision is right or wrong, depending on the fallout. And here's to say, and it's not to say that had Croatia gone on and won that final and he didn't award the penalty, maybe the French fans would have been calling foul on that decision. But I think it's so harsh when you see it in real time. Ivan Perisic had a nanosecond to react. In slow motion, it looks that much worse because it's frame by frame and you can see the ball clearly hit his hand. In real time, he's not got a clue where the ball is.
No, and he's blindsided, so he's actually not seeing the ball come in. It's a very clear case of ball to hand. And he realises as the ball's about to touch his hand, he's trying to get it out of the way. And he's actually stuck because he's had no time to react when the I think it was a corner kick came whipped in there. So, look, it's tough breaks, but at the end of the day, France won 4-2. Yeah. It wasn't a decisive goal, but I can tell you, being in the stadium, it was a decisive shift of momentum at that stage. Going into halftime, 2-1 up, after being pretty much defensively sitting back and letting Croatia have all the play onto you, it was a big situation at halftime. And, you know, you kind of knew that first goal out in the second half was going to win the game. It was just the way the situation was. And you feel sorry for the underdog. Croatia got no big breaks in the final. everything seemed to go over with France, and that's not a bad thing. You know, it's the way football is and the way sport is. But they made the most of it. They were clinical. They then scored a couple of pretty good goals: the Pogba goal, Mbappe goal. But they just got those. They took every opportunity they had. And was they've it? Been there and done that. They showed the experience of many of those big players in big situations. And we saw a lot of players we criticise regularly. Paul Pogba had a great match. And the French team, though, man for man in that setup, in that lineup, it just had so much talent. They just oozed talent.
So was that it, Mark? That it wasn't so much that France took a positive momentum from it. It was more that Croatia were thinking, hang on a second, we've come into this game having played three lots of extra time. We're massively unfancied against the French. We've played the better 45 minutes. We've scored the best goal of the half. We've given away an own goal. And now we're getting this. Yeah. They're just thinking, our luck's up here, surely.
Yeah, and I always felt, looking at this match, I think a lot. Croatia went through sort of three sets of penalties and extra time getting up there. And I felt that in the semi-final against England, I think they actually played their worst match of the tournament. Modric was terrible. He disappeared and his legs are gone in the second half of that match in particular. He disappeared. And he's their heartbeat. He's their box-to-box player. He breaks up play. He goes searching for every pass to wherever players, and he just keeps the game ticking over. Barely makes a bad decision, Modric, for them. Semi-final, he went missing against England. And then I just thought that their key guys just didn't have an
one
extra
game
gear.
Too many.
They had
one
no
game too
they
many.
Had no extra gear to go to, whereas you always fancy France, and the game opened up in the second half. You always fancied that Mbappe one-on-one is going to win that battle, and he's going to get some chances. And France probably could have scored another one or two goals. And Croatia were making so much hard work to try and really create a clear-cut opportunity. And look, it was a great final. I think France were the best team throughout the tournament. The final, though, just could have a bit of luck could have gone the other way, and that's what the neutrals wanted. But again, no problems with the final result. France, for me, best team in the tournament throughout the whole event.
That is the 2018 FIFA World Cup. Well documented what we've got in store in four and a bit years, because it will be a Winter World Cup, of course, let us not forget, in 2022. And then in 2026, we head for America, Canada, Mexico, a 48 nation World Cup. And my final one before we move on from the World Cup, 48 nation World Cup, a fan of that?
No, however, the Russia tournament would suggest that actually there's not a massive discrepancy between the bigger teams and the smaller teams, as is the big fear. When you let more teams in, the more chances of dead rubbers, the more hammerings that you get. There weren't really that many, were they, in Russia?
16 groups of three.
It just doesn't feel right.
16 groups of three, the top two from each of those groups going through into a last 32 before we get obviously to the last 16 in the quarterfinal. Then is it not a simple case that you're actually protecting the bigger nations? And there will be those out there, and again, do let us know your thoughts on this. And I know we've discussed this at length numerous times, but something just, it doesn't add up for me. A 48 nation World Cup, a World Cup finals is meant to be the very best 32. We're adding another 16 teams. And Mark,
I thought
Archer,
you'd be delighted Scotland have an outside chance of qualifying for a World Cup.
So do New Zealand, my man, as well.
We're likely to be there way before Scotland.
Yeah, that's because
we'll qualify through the Cook Islands, Tahiti and Fiji to qualify from Asia. Anyway, we'll be there, don't worry about that.
But let's be frank, Mark, and I know you've got some decent contacts over at FIFA. Is this not, and I don't want to put you in a tight jam here, but is this not, simply put, a cynical way of getting China and India to the biggest footballing party on the planet?
I think it's about getting more nations there, which creates more matches, and it creates more revenue, which means, in theory, the money in football, it creates more money for smaller nations to put into development and to build new pitches and to keep football as the global game. And I mean, that's what it's about, because the revenue in global football comes from the World Cup. It's as simple as that. And it's every 4 years. More teams, more ads you can sell on TV, you can sell bigger TV broadcast deals, you can get more sponsors involved because there's more global appeal, and more money for the global game of football. That's the theory. That's as simple. It's a dollars and cents game, and if they want to stay the dominant sport in the world, then they have to get more money to more nations. How do you do that? You create more teams at a World Cup. I mean, it's as simple as that.
He puts a good case, does the money man to my left, Matthew Fortune.
Or is it just money for the pockets of those that run the game?
Well, that's just where I was going with it. But an awful lot of people, it has been split whenever we've opened up this conversation up. An awful lot of people like the idea of it being a lot more welcoming to other footballing nations. Nations who have got the infrastructure, who have spent big on infrastructure, who just need that opportunity to expose themselves against the bigger nations, I guess. But 48, doesn't that not just seem a bit too large and And for a tournament that is already 4.5 weeks in length, we're adding an extra 16 matches.
I think it's the waning interest as well. I mean, it's a struggle anyway. The three of us are passionate about the sport, watched as many games as we possibly could. But the actual interest in those games between a selection of lesser nations, shall we say, is it going to drive revenue and interest and viewership? Probably not. And then the flip side of it as well is what happens to those nations if they do get humiliated on the big stage. Yeah. That's a lot to come back from. Yes, it might help generate a little bit of interest for a couple of weeks, but if it was my country going there and really being taught a lesson, I'm not sure that would have any knock-on effect of happiness through the country.
I think you can create a couple of arguments either way. With the more teams, you're going to play, instead of groups of four, you know, groups of three.
Yeah.
Two matches, if you slip up as a big team, you're in trouble straight away. So every game might have a bit more on it. Two of the games that should have been the best at the World Cup were actually the worst. England-Belgium twice were two of the worst games in the World Cup because they had nothing on it. Both teams wanted to lose the pool match and go to the supposedly easier side of the draw. Then they played the meaningless third and fourth playoff. Two teams that should have been much anticipated were nothing matches. Once you get through the pool of three, every game's a knockout. You're going to play multiple knockout phases, so you lose your out. That creates drama, it creates tension. It's games that you want to watch as opposed to dead rubbers between two teams like in England and Belgium twice. That didn't mean anything. So you can flip it either way. Look, you know, let's wait and see. Let's not judge it before it happens. It's a long way away still. Let's deal with the World Cup just over the road here first. And that's going to be interesting enough how that event transfolds. And there's a lot of work to do with that event before we think about Mexico, Canada, and of course the big old US of A.
Yeah, confirmation that the next World Cup final will be 7 days, I think it is, before Christmas, which will be odd, to say the least. A winter World Cup, just over 4 years, so we've got to wait that little extra, an extra few months for the next time the FIFA World Cup takes around. But you've got to say, credit where credit is due. Say what you want about Russia, politically, and we won't go down there. From a sporting standpoint, from a host nation of a FIFA World Cup, they covered themselves in an awful lot of glory.
Absolutely superb, Chris. I think there's a lot of people, and you saw how the ticket pickup from nations such as England, obviously there was a bit of positivity around that team, but people thinking, actually, it's not going to be as tricky or as bad. You and I met people on the plane who had no problem jumping into about three or four different cities over the course of a couple of weeks. I might have a financial problem or at home if I did the same thing, but from a logistical standpoint, it actually wasn't too difficult. One gentleman I met was flying into Samara and then getting a train and getting a cab, and it had all been super easy to organise. From a safety perspective, you and I never felt there was any concerns anywhere at all. Walking through town, there was people just keeping a watchful eye. It was a really, really smooth experience. I was fortunate enough to go to France in Euro 2016. I would be lying if I said I felt that was any better organised, to be honest.
Wow. Okay, let us know your thoughts then. 4001, we will draw a line under the FIFA World Cup. It is consigned now to the dustbin of history. It finished 6 days ago now. Incredible to think that the FIFA World Cup final was 6 days ago. What a 4.5 weeks it was, though, and it is a huge congratulations to France as your 2018 winners, to Russia for putting on a superb job, and yes, begrudgingly, we will give some praise as well to FIFA for the job they did as well. You are listening to The Grill. We will, when we come back, put you in the picture of what is going on from a live perspective. As I say, golf ongoing. It is moving Saturday over at Carnoustie. There's qualifying upcoming in the Formula One. There's live cricket over in Colombo. There's Super Rugby as well. And let us not forget, there's the small matter of Stage 13 of the Tour de France. All of those updates on the way when we come back.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
Indeed it is. Big screens dotted throughout the venue. We are currently watching a repeat of Manchester City's opening pre-season friendly against Borussia Dortmund. It was Dortmund, incidentally, who won that one by a goal to nil. Mario Götze, the man on the score sheet, so an opening defeat. It's only pre-season, I appreciate. It's all about fitness at this time of year for the players, but an opening defeat for the Premier League champions, Manchester City. I did mention that it was stage 13 in the Tour de France. I would be wrong. Stage 13 was, of course, yesterday, won by Peter Sagan. It is stage 14. We'll give you an update on what is currently happening out there. It is the fifth day in the fabled Alps for the boys today. We'll give you an update on that shortly. Before we do that, though, let's put you in the picture of what is going on over in Colombo. It is day two of the second test between Sri Lanka and South Africa. Sri Lanka, comprehensive winners in the first test. They're heading for another comprehensive victory in the second.
No, you did right. Stumps on day two in Colombo of the second test match. Sri Lanka firmly in control. They dismissed South Africa early today for 124. That's in reply to their first innings of 338. At stumps, Sri Lanka are 151 for three. Massive lead for Sri Lanka of 365 runs. 7 wickets remaining. And it looks like this match will be over on day three. massively underprepared pitches. They're turning square from day one, and that probably leads more weight to the argument that maybe they should disregard the toss at Test match cricket just to give opposing teams a chance, you know, on all surfaces. But Sri Lanka firmly in control. The amazing performance of this match, Chris, was the left arm spin of the South African left armer yesterday, Keshav Maharaj. He bowled, this was bowling figures, 41 overs, 10 maidens, 9 wickets, just 9 wickets, wow, for 129. The second best bowling figures ever by a South African bowler, the best figures ever by a South African outside of South Africa. 9 for 129 for the left arm spin of Keshav Maharaj. But that's not enough to really do too much damage. Sri Lanka, big first innings lead, and they have that lead at stumps on day two of 365 runs, 7 wickets remaining. They'll extend that to over 500 tomorrow, and then I'm sure they'll knock South Africa off without too much problems.
We will be talking about Pakistan. They have been in very impressive form over in Zimbabwe in their ODI series. We'll also be discussing India. They've named their 18-man squad for that opening 3 tests against England, the first of those getting underway on August the 1st. And I did say a little earlier, a Chinaman has been called up by India. It's not quite what it seems. We'll reveal all very shortly indeed. But let us put you in the picture. What is happening over there in France? The Tour de France starting to get into the nitty-gritty, the business end, the end of the Tour de France, the very much separates the men from the boys. Matthew Fortune is across this one. Geraint Thomas is the man in possession of the yellow jersey. Will he be in the man in possession of it, I wonder, come the end of the day?
Well, Thomas is currently about 3 minutes behind a small breakaway. We're around 25 minutes underway in the stage. And the weather conditions are not helping anybody. There's a lot of crosswind. They're split into about 3 groups at the moment. And it's not... The preview suggested that this was a stage where a breakaway could really make things stick. It's quite short. It's 180 kilometres. It's brutally hilly in the second half. So if there is a good gap there for an early breakaway team, it could be that this might be a day that yellow jersey time gets eaten into. As I say, he's about a minute and a half ahead at the moment. He's 3 minutes behind on the stage today. It's an interesting start, but there's not too many fireworks, shall we say, after the last couple of days. I think the organisers are going to be looking for a nice, calm, easy day, no crowd trouble. Yesterday was slightly calmer than it had been in Stage 12. Stage 12, of course, saw some really... I saw it described as hooligans on the hillside, and it's true. And regardless, and I'm sure we'll come on to it, what people think of Froome and Sky and the controversy around them, to be pushed and spat at by people that are there to watch you perform your sport is really, really not nice to see. Yesterday was slightly calmer. However, there was a flare thrown into the crowd. It's difficult to manage, of course, because you can't put barriers all the way up the side of Alpe d'Huez. It's really tricky. But you would kind of expect people, going back to what we were talking about on the World Cup, we didn't see any of that in football, and you would much rather associate that sort of behaviour with football fans. So it's an interesting one. We've lost a couple of riders, of course. A lot of sprinters failed to make the cut in Stage 12. Vincenzo Nibali, a former winner, he got injured. Strangely, catching his handlebars on a camera strap that was hanging from a spectator. Oh. He was taken to hospital with a broken vertebrae. Oh. It's funny that one big casualty was not really from the trouble, but it shows that people are getting too close to these riders.
Yeah, absolutely. The officials need to keep a close eye on that, and you're right to say that a flare was tossed into the peloton yesterday. Thankfully, no one injured in that, and as you rightly point out, the ill feeling, not the majority, there is a minority who have got it against Chris Froome, who are against Team Sky for the very well documented and publicised reasons. That being said, Chris Froome was found innocent of any wrongdoing, and an awful lot of the riders have been pointing out that Chris Froome, as a 4-time winner, as the defending champion, needs far more respect from some. Not many, but from some fans.
Well, even the French press are jumping on the case today. The Team Sky have been described as the snake with two heads in French newspapers today. That's not going to help anybody. It's a really disappointing attitude, regardless of what you think, as you say.
I do wonder, is that because the French have a rider who has aspirations of winning that yellow jersey in the case of Romain Bardet, but there's no doubt about it. Team Sky are up against it in more ways than one, and Chris Froome has... Well, he's... relented a little bit, because it's Geraint Thomas, the Welshman, who has come to the fore in this Tour de France thus far. And we were talking about this one on the way down here, Matt. There is a school of thought, certainly amongst some journalists, that this might have all been part of the plan, that in actual fact Team Sky always did want Geraint Thomas front and centre at this Tour de France.
It's a very interesting theory. I've read it in a couple of places, Chris. Of course, Froome is now charging for his 4th successive win. It will be 6-7 for Team Sky. Froome coming off the back of obviously a very controversial start to the season. He won the Giro d'Italia, and everybody assumed, perhaps rightly, that he was going to be Team Sky's number one man. In fact, Thomas has been, he's almost protesting too much.
Mm. That Froome is number one man. In interviews, he's obviously preempted about it because he's in a strong position, but he's really, really hammering home the point that Froome is the number one man. However, is he really? Because it would suggest the way that Thomas has been riding, he's really been putting his foot down to suggest that actually Froome is the distraction tactic to allow Geraint Thomas to free up, put some space between him and the rest of the GC. It's certainly one to watch. And the funny thing is, you wouldn't put that sort of behaviour past Team Sky for sure.
Absolutely not. It is all about the team ethos there. They want to remain the dominant force in world cycling. Watch this space on that one. Geraint Thomas, 1 minute 37 seconds ahead of his Team Sky teammate Chris Froome in the GC. Tom Dumoulin, the Dutchman, he's a further 11 seconds back. And there is some suggestion that with a time trial to come before we ride into the Champs-Élysées on the final day, of course, that stage 21, that Tom Dumoulin could eat into that lead and look out for an attack from the Dutchman on the hills. Of course, they head for the Pyrenees very shortly as well, so there's still an awful lot of racing to be done in this Tour de France, but the narrative has been set. Geraint Thomas is the man in possession of that yellow jersey. Will he hold on to it, I wonder, all the way through? It is a very interesting one. We'll keep you bang up to date with stage 14. So that's the cycling. What about the rugby? Some sad news this past week that Sam Warburton, the way and British and Irish Lions skipper, has been forced to retire. We'll touch on that in a little bit, but there is ongoing action. We're talking subcontinent, we're talking southern hemisphere, because it is Super Rugby. It is quarterfinal weekend, Mark Archer.
Yeah, it is indeed, and there's 5 minutes remaining of the third quarterfinal of Super Rugby. It's in Sydney. It's the Waratahs, the home team, New South Wales Waratahs, hosting the Highlanders from the deep south of New Zealand. It's the Waratahs that lead with 5 minutes remaining, 30 points to 23. It's been a dramatic turnaround. At half time, the Highlanders had a big lead, 23 points to 6. But 24 unanswered points by the Waratahs has put them in the lead. They've just had a yellow card, a player sin-binned for the rest of the game. So the Waratahs are down to 14 men, and the Highlanders are hot on attack. Can they get back into the match with a equaling try to even up the match going into the final minutes? Two matches this weekend so far. Yesterday, the result was in Wellington, where the Hurricanes made it 4 semi-finals in 4 years with a rugged one-point victory over the New Zealand rivals, the Chiefs, 32 points to 31. Earlier today in Christchurch, it's the defending champions, the eight-time Super Rugby winners, Crusaders, too clinical and classy against the Sharks. They won that match 40 points to 10. That's 13 consecutive victories for the Crusaders. So next weekend, the Crusaders will be at home against the Hurricanes, and I'll tell you in the next 5 or 10 minutes who will be prevailing from the third match. The Waratahs, can they hold on against the Highlanders? They kick off in Johannesburg at Emirates Park with the Lions hosting the Jaguares from Argentina.
You mentioned there 13 straight wins for the Crusaders, the defending champions, of course. It's now 13 matches that the South African teams have lost down in New Zealand. They simply cannot win when it comes to the playoffs in Super Rugby. It is one of the toughest tests in any sport, is heading, whether it's the All Blacks taking on the All Blacks on their own patch or taking on these dominant New Zealand sides. So, so difficult, with the time difference as well, of course, to go down there, to put your body on the line and try and win a rugby match. It's nigh on impossible.
Yeah, it's very tough when you've got short turnaround times, a couple of days to actually travel and actually prepare for a match. It's almost a 12-hour swing in time zones. It's extremely tough. But the Crusaders earned the number one seed throughout the season. They have to travel. The New Zealand teams do travel to South Africa and do travel to play the matches. And they've got the home seeding throughout the knockout stages, the playoff stages of the tournament. So, yeah, it's going to be a challenge for any team to go down there. If one team can beat the Crusaders, maybe it will be the Hurricanes. They only have to travel from Wellington. It's about an hour's flight down to Christchurch. Maybe it gives them a good chance. No jet lag there, no time differences. And the Hurricanes are stacked with All Blacks to take on. Obviously, plenty of All Blacks also in that Crusaders team. So a couple of minutes remaining in Sydney. It's still the Waratahs hanging on, 30 points to 23. We'll let you know who wins that game and is the third team to play in the semi-finals of Super Rugby.
45 minutes into our broadcast this afternoon, Robbie Greenfield would be having kittens by the fact that we haven't mentioned the golf. It is the 147th Open Championship over there in Carnoustie. We saw one or two of the big names, namely Dustin Johnson, the world number one, the world number two in the shape of Justin Thomas. Both of those individuals missing the cut yesterday. The first time that the world's top two have failed to make a cut at the Open since, I think it was 2011, when both Lee Westwood and Luke Donald missed the cut on that occasion. In terms of the leaderboard, stacked with Americans, Mark Archer.
Yeah, there are Americans particularly tight at the top. The leaders won't go off until late this evening, 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Obviously, long daylight hours up there in Carnoustie in Scotland, and so they'll be playing all sorts of hours. But two Americans tied for the top. Zach Johnson, who has won an Open Championship before and also a Masters, he's tied at 6 under par, rounds of 69 and 67 for the American. Tied with the little-known Kevin Kisner. Don't know too much about him, but they are in the lead at the moment. One shot further back, it's the American two-ball of Xander Schauffele and Pat Perez. But Tommy Fleetwood, he is lurking ominously. The man who finished second at the Open, the US Open, not that long ago in Long Island, is had the low round of the week so far, 65 for the man from Merseyside. And he's trying to become the first Englishman since Nick Faldo in 1992 to win an Open Championship. You talk about the big-name players missing the cut, but there are some big-name players there or thereabouts in the mix still. Rory McIlroy has ground his way to a score of 4 under par. Don't rule him out, the 2014 Open champion. He is set to move, and the scoring conditions look very good from what I saw earlier this morning. Little wind, the fairways have been softened down by the rain yesterday. The greens are approachable, and they're taking the fire out of that. So there could be some low scores today, given the nature, unless the wind gets up this afternoon in Carnoustie, which never rule that out either. Likes of Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler, two players that could do well this weekend, both at 3 under par. Brooks Koepka, the US Open champion, 2 under par. And Tiger Woods, there he is, rounds of 71 and 71 for par. Can he make a move on moving day Saturday?
You mentioned that there is potential for some low scores today. I can tell you Chris Wood, the Englishman, is on an absolute tear. 10 holes for him in his third round. He's already 6 under par for the day. That's catapulted him into contention at 4 under par. Patrick Reed as well, the Masters champion, who had a bit of a miserable, well, not a bit, he did have a miserable opening round of 75. He followed that up yesterday with a 70. I can tell you he is 5 under par for his round at 2 under. Justin Rose also 5 under today through 15. He's moved on to 2 under. So some one or two men making a move on moving Saturday over there at the Open. We will be live to Carnoustie at 4:30 to get all the very latest. Tiger Woods, what would you surmise today? Mark Archer needs to shoot a 66, 65 to give himself a real opportunity tomorrow?
At least he'll have to shoot 65, 66. It looks as though the scoring conditions are as good as it's been in the event so far. Some players are going low. Chris Wood is making a big move today, as is Patrick Reed and Justin Rose, as you likely said there. Guys are going to go low. The conditions, there's no wind. The fairways are soft. It's taking the sting out. The balls are rolling so far. Tiger Woods was hitting his stinger. A lot of players hitting irons off the tee. The driver hasn't been used predominantly. But the wet weather tends to suit players like Rory McIlroy. If the course plays longer, then players like Rory McIlroy come into their own, where they can control the ball, hit driver a lot more. But it's been tactical so far. That's what Carnoustie brings out of these players. Scoring hasn't been outstanding, but let's see what happens today. Conditions are very good for scoring. It's the best conditions of the week so far. No wind. The fairways are dampened down. It's just avoiding those traps, avoiding the Barry Byrne or whatever it's called there.
the Barry Byrne at the 18th.
Yeah, and then the players are definitely in play. So let's wait and see who can make a move today up at Carnoustie.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. As I say, we will be live to Carnoustie in about 45 minutes time. Formula One as well. Matt's keeping an eye on the wet conditions over there at the Hockenheim Ring as well. There is the German Grand Prix. An awful lot of expectation on Mercedes this weekend to produce a performance after their recent woes. There is Sebastian Vettel who leads the way in the Drivers' Championship. Ferrari leading the way in the Constructors' Championship. Qualifying gets underway in just over an hour's time, so we'll keep an eye on that for you as well. As always, get in touch with us on 4001. We will continue the conversation when we come back. Keen to put you in the picture of some transfer news. Everton getting set to smash their transfer record, 50 million on a player who is yet to be capped by his country. We'll tell you more when we come back.
This is The Grill, bringing you the biggest sports stories right now on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, we're keeping you bang up to date with the live sport as we go this afternoon. Welcome back to The Grill. It is myself, Chris McCarty, Mark Archer, and making his debut this afternoon, it is Matthew Fortune. If you've got a question for either of us, do get them on in on 4001. As I say, we are keeping you up to date with the live sport. We're also going to take a look back on the biggest sporting stories of the week. An awful lot to get through. Want to bring you up to date as well with some transfer news very, very shortly in the way of football. Before we do that, though, there is a full-time result over in New South Wales.
Yeah, full-time in Sydney, and the Waratahs have become the first Australian team to make this year's semi-finals of the Super Rugby. They defeated the Highlanders 30 points to 23. Massive second half comeback. The Waratahs trailed the Highlanders 23 points to 6 at half time, but 27 17 unanswered points got them into the lead and means that they run away with it 30 points to 23. They join the Crusaders, who will take on the Hurricanes in the first semi-final next week, and then the Waratahs now wait to see who will become victorious from the Lions taking on the Jaguares in the second semi-final. So we've got the Hurricanes taking on the Crusaders. The Waratahs wait to see who they will play in the second of next weekend's Super Rugby semi-finals.
Absolutely. We'll keep you bang up to date. That's a final, quarter-final, incidentally, getting underway at 5:05. We'll build up to that one over the course of the next hour. If you have missed the news yesterday, and I'm sure an awful lot of you were kept busy on a Friday afternoon, big news out of Tottenham Hotspur yesterday, both Heung-Min Son and Eric Lamela signing long-term contracts at I was going to say White Hart Lane. Do we know the name of their new stadium yet?
We don't yet, no.
They're going to sell it off, aren't they?
Of course.
I just wonder, Etihad, would they be interested? Given the fact that Emirates is across the way in North London, could Etihad be interested?
I think we have an Etihad stadium already, don't we?
That's true. There could be Etihad Arena, perhaps, if they've got enough money. We've got Etihad Stadium up in Manchester, Etihad Arena. But watch this space on that one. But Tottenham definitely looking to sell off their naming rights.
As far as everybody's concerned. And they're bringing extra money in through the NFL, of course. But it would be mad in this day and age to build a new 61,000, about 400 seats more than just down the road, which is brilliantly childish from Spurs, you have to honour it. They'll need some more money in for sure.
I've heard, we got a text in on the show during the week on Sports Tonight, 7 till 9 on Dubai, 103.8, that one individual had popped along to have a little look at the stadium, and he said that it just looks magnificent. There will be no finer stadium, and I appreciate a new stadium will crop up in the next few months, and it will then take its probably place as the world's best as technology, etc., moves on. But it looks incredible. And that idea to build the one bank, the one tier stand behind one of the goals, I mean, you've got to take your hat off to Spurs and the architects behind that new arena. It looks unbelievable.
It looks incredible. And White Hart Lane, I've been a few times, in fact, in the away end as an Arsenal fan. And begrudgingly, and I can say this because hopefully no one at home will hear me say nice things about Tottenham Hotspur, it's one of the most phenomenal atmospheres. And that was with about 34,000 people. I was there when Arsenal got beat 5-1.
Oof.
And the place was... It was rocking. Genuinely, it was uncomfortable underfoot. They were making so much noise. So to put an entire bank of fans roaring them on from behind is absolutely genius. And it does look incredible.
Yeah, built on the Sigduna Park. It was Borussia Dortmund Westfalenstadion is how I remember it. It's been sold off for sponsorship over the years as well. Dortmund's home ground. But they've built it on that yellow wall, as it was, the famous stand behind one of the goals over in Germany. So congratulations to Spurs. Two players as well, important cogs in that team, signing long-term deals. Eric Lamela, Heung-Min Son, good players for Spurs.
Absolutely, and off the back of Harry Kane and the manager Pochettino also signing deals. It's masking what has been a tricky summer for Spurs so far. No signings, linked with a few players. A number of their players did very well in the World Cup as well and also linked away, but they need a statement signing to move into that stadium. If they want to learn anything from their old friends down the road, is that they need something to cheer when you move into a new stadium, because it's going to be tough for them.
Absolutely.
They need to force a couple of these deals over the line. Having Heung-Min Son signing on, I think, is brilliant for them, the manager, and of course Kane. But fans like new players to come in.
Absolutely. Watch the space. I think one of only two Premier League clubs are Spurs who have yet to sign a new player in this off-season. The big transfer news from the week, I guess, is Liverpool Football Club smashing the world record for a goalkeeper. £66.8 million or thereabouts for the signing of the Brazilian number one, Alisson. You're a keeper in your spare time, Matthew Fortune. Not a very good one, but you are a keeper in your spare time, a little bit like myself. Alisson, £66.8 million for a goalkeeper. Is that a little too much, or is that the going rate these days?
I think it's the going rate these days, Chris. We were just talking off there about if he's worth this, what are the likes of De Gea and Courtois worth? And the numbers being thrown around for them, no one's balking at those. Mm. If David De Gea or Courtois is different because he has a year left of his contract, but if there was €100 million on the table for David De Gea, people wouldn't bat an eyelid. So £66 million for a player as competent as Alisson, who fits the way Liverpool play, who has moulded himself very much on that modern keeper-sweeper ethos, I think... It's not mad for Liverpool to now have the most expensive goalkeeper in the world and the most expensive defender just a few months apart.
they're making a statement there, and I think that's what they needed to do.
We've got a man from London who does support Arsenal. We've got a Scotsman who supports, yes, Manchester United, and we've got a Kiwi who supports Manchester United. Sticking on Liverpool for a second, Arch, begrudgingly, you've got to doff your cap to that football club. Over the last 18 months, their business has been very impressive. Mohamed Salah, okay, in hindsight, it's a wonderful thing. I said it at the time, I'd expect them to be a good signing. Did I expect them to score 44 goals? No, I didn't, but an impressive piece of business. They added Virgil van Dijk in January. They've added Naby Keita. They've added Fabinho. They've now added Alisson, who for me is one of the top five goalkeepers in world football. And okay, it's easy for me to say that. They've just spent a world record. But from what I've seen of Alisson, that is a statement signing. Are they now the best equipped to push Manchester City close? Because for my money, on paper at the very least, that starting 11 is as good as there is now in the Premier League.
Look, let's be totally honest. They've been extremely aggressive in the transfer market in the last 24 months. They've made big, aggressive, bold moves. They've looked to strengthen the team when there's been glaring weakness. And the glaring weakness has been in goalkeeper. You know, Karius and Mignolet have been shocking at times. They've been good at times, been okay, but they've made some big errors. And you're not going to win a title, or you're not going to win a Champions League, as we've seen, with weakness at the goalkeeper. We saw it in the World Cup. The best teams that were there or thereabouts had good goalkeepers.
Absolutely.
It really counts in the big pressure matches, the calmness, the composure, the ability to play out from the back and not just to stop shots. You need good goalkeepers now to win things in football. You can't hide that. You can't hide that in the modern day. And they've made the big moves in the back four, where they've had some weaknesses in the past. They've got some youngsters on the flanks there with Trent Arnold and Andrew Robertson,
yeah.
And now with Van Dijk in the middle...
Keita, Fabinho in the middle of the park.
They've shored up. Even Dejan Lovren, much criticised at times in the Premier League, had a relatively successful and solid World Cup. So they've got some strength and depth. How they all blend together, how they get playing as a team to find that, you've still got to probably ask the question, how will they gel? How will they find a system within the new players? But I think Jurgen Klopp's done a good job in the past of getting guys in. He's got his own particular style. He seems to be a player's manager, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And he gets them playing for him. And so let's wait and see. I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt first, but let's wait and see, because Liverpool have underachieved for almost three decades now, in the Premier League in particular. So let's wait and see. The proof will be in the pudding for me.
There's an awful lot of fans of opposing clubs poking fun at Jurgen Klopp. I think what was his comment, Matt, and you were telling me this as we were driving down to Barasti this afternoon, that he did have some choice words about Manchester United, or I think it was directed towards Manchester United, after they at the time spent a world record on Paul Pogba, that he is a manager that doesn't like spending large sums of money.
Very much so. It's a quote that has not aged well for old Jurgen, has it? Clubs can go out and spend more money and collect top players. I want to do it differently. And then he continues, the day that this is football, I'm not in a job anymore.
Yeah, interesting from Jurgen Klopp. That being said, and I'm sure he won't lose any sleep over the fact that fans are poking fun at that quote, we all say things, and I can recall a number of things that I've said, namely that Claudio Ranieri would be the first manager to get sacked a couple of years ago in the Premier League, and we all know what happened that year. Leicester City went on to win the Premier League.
It is worth pointing out, though, the amount of money that Liverpool have now spent in the last two seasons, and particularly in this off-season, if they don't contend for a Premier League title, if they aren't in contention for a Premier League title at the end of the year,
careful on this
statement, if they don't progress in the Champions League, well, then you've got to ask questions. The same questions that get asked about Man United and the money they spent, the same as we'll ask about Manchester City with the money that they have. If those teams do not contend until the very last weeks of the season, then you've got to ask questions of the management.
I think there's some credit in the bank there, Arch, because you look at what Jurgen Klopp has done.
What have they won?
Not won much.
What have they won? Nothing.
As a United fan, what have we added?
Three titles in 4 years.
Three titles in
4 years. Europa Cup.
Please don't include the Community Shield in that, in the League Cup. Nonsense.
They've won more than Liverpool, Chris.
Nonsense.
Fact.
Liverpool have been to a Champions League final, Mark Archer. And again, I'm sticking up for Liverpool Football Club here. Manchester United got beat by Sevilla. If I'm a Liverpool fan or a Man United fan, let me ask you this question. Who's more positive right now, a Liverpool fan or a Man United fan?
Let's wait and see at the end of the season. I'm confident going into
the year. I'll ask you that, Matt. Who would you be more, if you're an Arsenal fan, but who should be happier right now, United or Liverpool fans?
Football is all about the excitement. These 3 weeks before the season starts, I mean, I've got blind fantasies of Arsenal running away with the Europa League and Premier League title. And that's what this part of the season is absolutely supposed to be about. If I was a Liverpool fan, I would be riding a crest of a wave. I'd be so excited about what was going to happen. If I was a Manchester United fan and I was looking at my manager's press conference the other day where he was pleading for everyone to feel so sorry for him because he doesn't have enough players, it just sucks the whole life out of it. So to answer your question, Chris, well, I'd still be an Arsenal fan, but it'd probably be Liverpool in this instance.
Yeah, let us know on 4001. Mark Archer, and he's right to point out it is all about trophies, but again, I'm saying this begrudgingly, I'm not Liverpool's fan, although many people have accused me of being a closet Liverpool fan. That is not the case. What I do see, though, is a football club that is heading very much in the right direction, that seem to all be in unison, moving forward and enjoying their football, and that is so vital. We'll continue this conversation when we come back. Keep your thoughts coming in on 4001. I promise I will get to your texts when we come back. For now, though, it is news headline time. When we come back, more chat on all things sport.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.